13. On a grayish-blue rink, where there were tennis courts in summer, lightly powdered with snow, the townsfolk were disporting themselves cautiously, and at the very moment the Lusians passed by on their morning stroll, the sprightliest of the skaters, a besweatered young fellow, gracefully launched into a Dutch step and sat down hard on the ice. Father, in a small public garden, a 3-year-old boy all in red, walking unsteadily on woolen legs, made his way to a stirrup stone, scraped off with one fingerless little hand some snow that was lying there in an appetizing hillock, and raised it to his mouth, for which he was immediately seized from behind and spanked.
"Oh, you poor little thing," said Mrs. Lusian, looking back.
A bus went along the whitened asphalt, leaving two thick black stripes behind it. From a shop of talking and playing machines came the sound of fragile music, and someone closed the door so the music would not catch cold. A dachshund with a patched blue little overcoat and low-swinging ears stopped and sniffed the snow, and Mrs. Lusian just had time to stroke it. Something light, sharp, and whitish kept striking them in the face, and when they peered at the empty sky, bright specks danced before their eyes. Mrs. Lusian skidded and looked reproachfully at her gray snow boots. By the Russian food store, they met the Alfiorov couple.
"Quite a cold snap," exclaimed Alfiorov with a shake of his yellow beard.
"Oh, don't kiss it. The glove's dirty,"
said Mrs. Lusian, and looking with a smile at Mrs. Alfiorov's enchanting, always animated face, she asked why she never came to visit them.
"And you're putting on weight, sir," growled
Alfiorov, squinting playfully at Lusian's stomach, exaggerated by his wadded overcoat. Lusian looked imploringly at his wife.
"Remember, you're always welcome," she said, nodding.
"Wait, Mashenka, do you know their telephone number?" asked Alfiorov. "You know? Oh, fine. Well, so long, as they say in Soviet Russia. My deepest respects to your mother."
"There's something a little mean and a little pathetic about him," said Mrs. Lusian, taking her husband's arm and changing step in order to match his. "But, Mashenka, what a darling! What eyes! Don't walk so fast, dear Lusian, it's slippery."
The light snow ceased to fall. A spot of sky gleamed through palely, and the flat, bloodless disk of the sun floated out.
"You know what? Let's go to the right today," suggested Mrs. Lusian. "We've never been that way, I believe."
"Look, oranges,"
said Lusian with relish, and recalled how his father had asserted that when you pronounce lemon, lemon in Russian, you involuntarily pull a long face. But when you say apelsin, orange, you give a broad smile. The salesgirl deftly spread the mouth of the paper bag and rammed the cold, pocked red globes into it. Lusian began to peel an orange as he walked, frowning in anticipation that the juice would squirt in his eye. He put the peel in his pocket because it would have stood out too vividly on the snow, and because perhaps you could make jam with it.
"Is it good?" asked his wife.
Lusian smacked his lips on the last segment, and with a contented smile was about to take his wife's arm again, but suddenly he stopped and looked around. Having thought for a moment, he walked back to the corner and looked at the name of the street. Then he quickly caught up with his wife again and thrust out his cane in the direction of the nearest house, an ordinary gray stone house separated from the street by a small garden behind iron railings.
"My dad used to reside here," said Lusian. 35A. 35A,
his wife repeated after him, not knowing what to say, and looking up at the windows. Lusian walked on, cutting snow away from the railings with his cane. Presently, he stopped, stock still, in front of a stationery store where the wax dummy of a man with two faces, one sad and the other joyful, was throwing open his jacket alternately to left and right. The fountain pen, clipped into the left pocket of his white waistcoat, had sprinkled the whiteness with ink, while on the right was the pen that never ran. Lucian took a great fancy to the bifacial man and even thought of buying him.
"Listen, Lucian," said his wife when he had had his fill of the window, "I've wanted to ask you for a long time. Haven't some things remained after your father's death? Where are they all?"
Lucian shrugged his shoulders.
"There was a man called Krushenko," he muttered after a while. "I don't understand," said his wife questioningly. "He wrote to me in Paris," explained Lucian reluctantly, "about the death and funeral and all that, and that he preserved the things left after the late father."
"Oh, Lucian," she sighed, "what you do to the language."
She reflected a moment and added,
"It doesn't matter to me, but I just thought it might be pleasant for you to have those things, as having belonged to your father."
Lucian remained silent. She imagined those unwanted things, perhaps the pen that old man Lucian wrote his books with, some documents or other, photographs, and she grew sad and mentally reproached her husband for hard-heartedness.
"But one thing has to be done without fail," she said decisively. "We must go to the cemetery to see his grave, to see that it's not neglected."
"Cold and far," said Lucian.
"We'll do it in a day or two," she decided. "The weather's bound to change. Careful, please, there's a car coming."
The weather got worse, and Lucian, remembering that depressing waste patch and the cemetery wind, begged for their trip to be postponed to the following week. The frost, incidentally, was extraordinary. They closed the ice rink, which was always unlucky. Last winter it had been thaw after thaw, and a pool in place of ice, and now such a cold spell that not even schoolboys were up to skating. In the parks, little high-breasted birds lay on the snow with feet in the air. The helpless mercury, under the influence of its surroundings, fell ever lower and lower, and even the polar bears in the zoo found that the management had overdone it. The Lucian apartment turned out to be one of those fortunate flats with heroic central heating, where one did not have to sit around in fur coats and blankets. His wife's parents, driven insane by the cold, were remarkably willing guests of the central heating. Lucian, wearing the old jacket that had been saved from destruction, sat at his desk, assiduously drawing a white cube standing before him. His father-in-law walked about the study, telling long, perfectly proper anecdotes, or else sat on the sofa with the newspaper, from time to time breathing deep and then clearing his throat. His mother-in-law and wife stayed by the tea table, and from the study across the dark drawing room, one could see the bright yellow lampshade in the dining room, his wife's illuminated profile on the brown background of the sideboard, and her bare arms, which, with her elbows a long way in front of her on the table, she bent back to one shoulder, her fingers interlaced, or suddenly she would smoothly stretch an arm out and touch some gleaming object on the tablecloth. Lucian put the cube aside, took a clean sheet of paper, prepared a tin box with buttons of watercolor in it, and hastened to draw this vista. But while he was painstakingly tracing out the lines of perspective with the aid of a ruler, something changed at the far end. His wife disappeared from the vivid rectangle of the dining room, and the light went out and came on again closer in the drawing room, and no perspective existed any longer. In general, he rarely got to the colors, and indeed preferred pencil. The dampness of watercolors made the paper buckle unpleasantly, and the wet colors would run together. On occasion, it would be impossible to get rid of some extraordinarily tenacious Prussian blue. No sooner would you get a small bit of it on the very tip of your brush than it would already be running all over the enamel inside of the box, devouring the shade you had prepared and turning the water in the glass a poisonous blue. There were thick tubes with India ink and ceruse, but the caps invariably got lost. The necks would dry up, and when he pressed too hard, the tube would burst at the bottom, and thence would come crawling and writhing a fat worm of goo. His daubings were fruitless, and even the simplest things, a vase with flowers or a sunset copied from a travel folder of the Riviera, came out spotty, sickly, horrible. But drawing was nice. He drew his mother-in-law, and she was offended. He drew his wife in profile, and she said that if she looked like that, there was no reason to marry her. On the other hand, his father-in-law's high, starched collar came out very well. Lucien took great pleasure in sharpening pencils and in measuring things before him, screwing up one eye and raising his pencil with his thumb pressed against it, and he would move his eraser over the paper with care, pressing with his palm on the sheet, for he knew from experience that otherwise there would come a loud crack and the sheet would crease. And he would blow off the particles of rubber very delicately, fearing to smudge the drawing by touching it with his hand. Most of all, he liked what his wife had advised him to begin with and what he constantly returned to: white cubes, pyramids, cylinders, and a fragment of plaster ornament that reminded him of drawing lessons at school, the sole acceptable subject. He was soothed by the thin lines that he drew and redrew 100 times, achieving a maximum of sharpness, accuracy, and purity. And it was remarkably nice to shade, tenderly and evenly, not pressing too hard, in regularly applied strokes. "Finished," he said, holding the paper away from him and looking at the completed cube through his eyelashes. His father-in-law put on his pince-nez and looked at it for a long time, nodding his head. His mother-in-law and wife came from the drawing-room and also looked.
"It even casts a tiny shadow," said his wife. "A very, very handsome cube."
"Well done. You're a real cubist," said his mother-in-law.
Lucien, smiling on one side of his mouth, took the drawing and looked round the walls of his study. By the door, one of his productions was already hanging, a train on a bridge spanning an abyss. There was also something in the drawing-room, a skull on a telephone directory. In the dining-room there were some extremely round oranges, which everyone for some reason took for tomatoes. And the bedroom was adorned by a bas-relief done in charcoal, and a confidential conversation between a cone and a pyramid. He went out of the study, his eyes roving over the walls, and his wife said with a sigh, "I wonder where dear Lucien will hang this one."
"You haven't yet deigned to inform me," began her mother, pointing with her chin to a heap of gaudy travel folders lying on the desk.
"But I don't know myself," said Mrs. Lucien.
"It's very difficult to decide. Everywhere's beautiful. I think we'll go to Nice first."
"I would advise the Italian lakes," said her father. And folding up the newspaper and removing his pince-nez, he began to relate how beautiful the lakes were.
"I'm afraid he's grown rather tired of the talk about our journey," said Mrs. Lucien. "One fine day we'll simply get in the train and go."
"Not before April," said her mother imploringly. "You promised me, you know."
Lucien returned to the study.
"I had a box of thumbtacks somewhere," he said, looking at the desk and slapping his pockets, whereupon he again for the third or fourth time had a feeling there was something in his left pocket, but not the box, and there was not time to investigate. The tacks were found on the desk. Lucien took them and hastily went out.
"Oh, I quite forgot to tell you. Just imagine, yesterday morning..."
and she began to tell her daughter that she had been called by a woman who had unexpectedly arrived from Russia. This woman had often visited them as a young girl in St. Petersburg. It turned out that several years ago she had married a Soviet businessman or official. It had been impossible to understand exactly. And on her way to a spa where her husband was going to gather new strength, she had stopped off for a week or two in Berlin.
"I feel a bit awkward, you know, about a Soviet citizen coming to our place, but she's so persistent. I'm amazed she's not afraid to telephone. Why, if they learn in Savitsia that she rang me up." "Oh, Mama, she's probably a very unhappy woman. She's broken out temporarily to freedom, and she feels like seeing somebody."
"Well, then, I'll pass her on to you," said her mother with relief, "especially as it's warmer at your place."
And several days afterward, at midday, the lady appeared. Luzhin was still slumbering, since he had slept badly the night before. Twice he woke up with choking cries, suffocated by a nightmare. And now Mrs. Luzhin somehow did not feel up to guests. The visitor turned out to be a slim, animated, nicely made-up, nicely bobbed lady who was dressed, like Mrs. Luzhin, with expensive simplicity. Loudly, interrupting one another, and assuring one another that neither had changed a bit, except perhaps to grow prettier, they went through to the study, which was cozier than the drawing-room. The newcomer remarked to herself that Mrs. Luzhin, 10 to 12 years ago, had been a rather graceful, lively little girl, and now had grown plumper, paler, and quieter, while Mrs. Luzhin found that the modest, silent young lady who used to visit them and was in love with a student, later shot by the Reds, had turned into a very interesting, confident lady.
"So this is your Berlin. Thank you kindly. I almost died with cold. At home in Leningrad, it's warmer, really warmer."
"How is it, St. Petersburg? It must have changed a lot," asked Mrs. Luzhin.
"Of course it's changed," replied the newcomer jauntily.
"And a terribly difficult life," said Mrs. Luzhin, nodding thoughtfully.
"Oh, what nonsense! Nothing of the sort. They're working at home, building, even my boy. What, you didn't know I had a little boy? Well, I have. I have a cute little squirt. Well, even as he says that at home in Leningrad, they work, while in Berlin, the bourgeois don't do anything. And in general, he finds Berlin far worse than home and doesn't even want to look at anything. He's so observant, you know, and sensitive. No, speaking seriously, the child's right. I myself feel how we've outstripped Europe. Take our theater. Why, you in Europe don't have a theater. It just doesn't exist. I'm not in the least, you understand, not in the least praising the communists. But you have to admit one thing. They look ahead. They build intensive construction."
"I don't understand politics," said Mrs. Luzhin slowly and plaintively. "But it just seems to me..."
"I'm only saying that one has to be broad-minded," continued the visitor hastily. "Take this, for instance. As soon as I arrived, I bought an émigré paper. Of course, my husband said, joking, you know, 'Why do you waste money, my girl, on such filth?' He expressed himself worse than that, but let's call it that for the sake of decency. But me, 'No,' I said, 'you have to look at everything, find out everything absolutely impartially.' And imagine, I opened the paper and began to read, and there was such slander printed there, such lies, and everything so crude."
"I rarely see the Russian newspapers," said Mrs. Luzhin. "A mama, for instance, gets a Russian newspaper from Serbia, I believe."
"It is a conspiracy," continued the lady. "Nothing but abuse, and nobody dares to utter a peep in our favor."
"Really, let's talk about something else," said Mrs. Luzhin distractedly. "I can't express it. I'm very poor at speaking about these matters, but I feel you're mistaken. Now, if you want to talk about it with my parents some day..."
And saying this, Mrs. Luzhin imagined to herself, not without a certain pleasure, her mother's bulging eyes and strident cries.
"Well, you're still little," the lady indulgently smiled. Tell me what you are doing. What does your husband do? What is he?
He used to play chess, replied Mrs. Lusian. He was a remarkable player. But then he overstrained himself, and now he's resting. And please, you mustn't talk to him about chess.
Well, yes, yes, I know he's a chess player, said the newcomer. But what is he, a reactionary, a white guardist?
Really, I don't know, laughed Mrs. Lusian.
I've heard a thing or two about him, continued the newcomer. When your maman told me you had married a Lusian, I thought immediately that it was he. I had a good acquaintance in Leningrad, and she told me, with such naive pride, you know, how she had taught her little nephew to play chess, and how he later became a remarkable...
At this point in the conversation, a strange noise occurred in the next room, as if someone had knocked against something there and let out a cry.
One moment, said Mrs. Lusian, jumping up from the sofa, and was about to slide open the door to the drawing-room, but, changing her mind, she went via the hall.
In the drawing-room, she saw a completely unexpected Lusian. He was in his dressing-gown and bedroom slippers and holding a piece of white bread in one hand. But it was not this, of course, that was surprising. The surprising thing was the trembling excitement distorting his face, the wide-open, gleaming eyes, and the forehead looking as if it had grown lumpier, the vein as if it had swollen, and catching sight of his wife, he appeared to pay no attention to her at first, but continued to stand looking with open mouth in the direction of the study. An instant later, it turned out his excitement was joyful. He clicked his teeth joyfully at his wife, then turned heavily in a circle, almost knocking the palm over, lost a slipper which slithered like a live thing into the dining room, where some cocoa was steaming, and speedily went after it.
"Nothing, nothing," said Lusian slyly, and like a man reveling in a secret find, he slapped himself on the knees, and closing his eyes began to shake his head.
"That lady is from Russia," said his wife probingly. "She knows your aunt who, well, just an aunt of yours."
"Excellent, excellent," said Lusian, and suddenly choked with laughter.
What am I frightened of? She thought. He's simply feeling jolly. He woke up in a good mood and wanted, perhaps.
Is it some private joke, Lusian?
Yes, yes, said Lusian, and added, finding a way out, I wanted to introduce myself in my dressing gown.
So then we're feeling jolly. That's good, she said with a smile.
Have something to eat, and then get dressed. It seems to be a little warmer this morning.
And leaving her husband in the dining room, Mrs. Lusian quickly returned to the study. Her visitor was sitting on the couch and looking at some views of Switzerland on the pages of a travel leaflet.
Listen, she said, catching sight of Mrs. Lusian, I'm going to take advantage of you. I need to buy a few things, and I have absolutely no idea where the best stores are here. Yesterday I stood a solid hour in front of a store window, standing and thinking that perhaps there are stores that are even better. And then my German isn't up to much.
Lusian remained sitting in the dining room and continued from time to time to slap himself on the knees. And there was really something to celebrate. The combination he had been struggling to discern since the ball had suddenly revealed itself to him, thanks to a chance phrase that had come flying out of the next room. During these first minutes, he had still only had time to feel the keen delight of being a chess player, and pride and relief, and that physiological sensation of harmony which is so well known to artists. He still made many more small motions before he realized the true nature of his unusual discovery. Finished his cocoa, shaved, transferred his studs to a clean shirt. And suddenly, the delight vanished, and he was overcome by other sensations, just as some combination, known from chess problems, can be indistinctly repeated on the board in actual play. So now, the consecutive repetition of a familiar pattern was becoming noticeable in his present life,
and as soon as his initial delight in having established the actual fact of the repetition had passed, as soon as he began to go carefully over his discovery, Lucian shuddered. With vague admiration and vague horror, he observed how awesomely, how elegantly, and how flexibly, move by move, the images of his childhood had been repeated. Country house, town, school, aunt. But he still did not quite understand why this combinational repetition inspired his soul with such dread. He felt one thing keenly, a certain vexation that he had gone so long without noticing the cunning sequence of moves. And now, recalling some trifle, and there had been so many of them, and at times so skillfully presented, that the repetition was almost concealed, Lucian was indignant with himself for not having reflected, for not taking the initiative, but with trustful blindness letting the combination unfold. But now he resolved to be more circumspect, to keep an eye on the further development of these moves, if there was to be one, and, of course, to maintain his discovery in impenetrable secret, to be merry, extraordinarily merry. But from that day on, there was no rest for him. He had, if possible, to contrive a defense against this perfidious combination, to free himself of it. And for this, he had to foresee its ultimate aim, its dire direction. But this did not yet appear feasible. And the thought that the repetition would probably continue was so frightening that he was tempted to stop the clock of life, to suspend the game for good, to freeze. And at the same time, he noticed that he continued to exist, that some kind of preparation was going on, a creeping development, and that he had no power to halt this movement. Perhaps his wife would have noticed the change in Lucian sooner, his wooden jollity between intervals of sullenness, had she been with him more these days. But it so happened that it was precisely during these days that she was taken advantage of, as had been promised, by the importunate lady from Russia, who forced her to spend hours taking her from store to store, and unhurriedly tried on hats, dresses, and shoes, and then paid the Lucians prolonged visits. She continued to maintain, as before, that there was no theater in Europe, and to pronounce Leningrad, instead of Petersburg, with cold glibness, and for some reason Mrs. Lucian took pity on her, accompanied her to cafes, and bought her son, a fat, gloomy little boy deprived of the gift of speech in the presence of strangers, toys which he accepted fearfully and unwillingly, whereupon his mother affirmed that there was nothing here that he liked, and that he yearned to return to his little co-pioneers. She also met Mrs. Lucian's parents, but unfortunately the conversation about politics did not take place. They reminisced about former acquaintances, while Lucian, silently and concentratedly, fed chocolates to little Ivan, and Ivan, silently and concentratedly, ate them, and then turned deep red and was hastily led out of the room. Meanwhile, the weather got warmer, and once or twice Mrs. Lucian said to her husband that once this unfortunate woman with her unfortunate child and unpresentable husband had finally left, they should go the very first day without putting it off and visit the cemetery. And Lucian nodded with an assiduous smile. The typewriter, geography, and drawing were abandoned, for he knew now that all this was part of the combination, was an intricate repetition of all the moves that had been taken down in his childhood. Ridiculous days! Mrs. Lucian felt she was not paying enough attention to her husband's moods. Something was slipping out of control. And yet she continued to listen politely to the newcomer's chatter and to translate her demands to shop assistants. And it was particularly unpleasant when a pair of shoes that had already been worn once turned out to be unsuitable, and she had to accompany her to the store
while the purple-faced lady bawled out the firm in Russian and demanded the shoes be changed. And then she had to be soothed and her caustic expressions considerably toned down in the German version. On the evening before her departure, she came, together with little Ivan, to say goodbye. She left Ivan in the study while she went to the bedroom with Mrs. Luzhin, who for the 100th time showed her her wardrobe. Ivan sat on the couch and scratched his knee, trying not to look at Luzhin, who also did not know where to look, and was thinking how to occupy the flabby child.
"Telephone!" exclaimed Luzhin finally in a high voice, and pointing to it with his finger, he began to laugh with deliberate astonishment.
But Ivan, after looking sullenly in the direction of Luzhin's finger, averted his eyes, his lower lip hanging.
"Train and precipice!"
cried Luzhin again, and stretched out his other hand, pointing to his own picture on the wall. Ivan's left nostril filled with a glistening droplet, and he sniffed, looking apathetically before him.
"The author of A Certain Divine Comedy!"
bellowed Luzhin, raising a hand to the bust of Dante. Silence. A slight sniffing. Luzhin was tired by his gymnastic movements, and also grew still. He began to wonder whether there was any candy in the dining room, or whether to play the phonograph in the drawing room. But the little boy on the couch hypnotized him with his mere presence, and it was impossible to leave the room.
"A toy would do it," he said to himself,
then looked at his desk, measured the paper knife against the little boy's curiosity, found that his curiosity would not be roused by it, and began in despair to burrow in his pockets. And here again, as many times before, he felt that his left pocket, although empty, mysteriously retained some intangible contents. Luzhin thought that such a phenomenon was capable of interesting little Ivan. He sat down on the edge of the couch, beside him, and winked slyly.
"Conjuring trick," he said,
and started by showing that the pocket was empty.
"This hole has no connection with the trick," he explained.
Listlessly and malevolently, Ivan watched his movements.
"But nevertheless, there is something here," said Luzhin rapturously, and winked. "In a lining," snorted Ivan, and with a shrug of his shoulders, turned away.
"Right," cried Luzhin, miming delight, and thrust one hand through the hole, holding on to the bottom of the jacket with his other one. At first, some kind of a red corner came into view, and then the whole object, something in the shape of a flat leather notebook. Luzhin looked at it with raised brows, turned it around in his hands, pulled a little flap out of its slit, and cautiously opened the thing. It was not a notebook, but a small folding chessboard of Morocco leather. Luzhin immediately recalled that it had been given to him at a club in Paris. All the participants in that tournament were given this knick-knack, some firm's advertisement, not simply a souvenir from the club. Lateral compartments on both leaves of this pocketboard contained little celluloid pieces resembling fingernails, and each one bore the picture of a chess figure. These were placed in position on the board by inserting the pointed end into a tiny crack at the lower edge of each square, so that the rounded top of the piece with the drawn figure on it lay flat on the square. The effect was very elegant and neat. One could not help admiring the little red and white board, the smooth celluloid fingernails, and also the stamped gold letters along the horizontal edge of the board and the golden numbers along the vertical one. Opening his mouth wide with pleasure, Luzhin began to slip in the pieces, at first just a row of pawns along the second rank, but then he changed his mind and with the tips of his fingers taking the tiny insertable figures out of their compartments, he set out the position of his game with Turati at the point where it had been interrupted. This setting out was accomplished almost instantaneously, and immediately the whole material side of the matter dropped away. The tiny board lying open in the palm of his hand became intangible and weightless. The Morocco dissolved in a pink and cream haze, and everything disappeared, save the chess position itself, complex, pungent, charged with extraordinary possibilities. Lucian, one finger pressed to his temple, was so immersed in thought that he did not notice that Ivan, for lack of something to do, had clambered down from the couch and had started to rock the black upright of the standard lamp. It heeled over, and the light went out. Lucian came to his senses in complete darkness, and for the first moment did not realize where he was or what was going on around him. An invisible creature was fidgeting and grunting close by, and suddenly the orange shade lit up again with transparent light, and a pale little boy with a shaven head was kneeling and straightening out the cord. Lucian started and banged the board shut. His terrible little double, little Lucian, for whom the chess pieces had been set out, crawled over the carpet on his knees. All this had happened once before. And again, he had been caught, had not understood how exactly the repetition of a familiar theme would come out in practice. The following instant, everything regained its balance. Ivan, snuffling, clambered back onto the couch. In the slight gloom beyond the orange light floated Lucian's study, swaying gently. The red Morocco notebook lay innocently on the carpet. But Lucian knew that this was all a trick. The combination had still not completely developed, and soon a new dire repetition would manifest itself. Bending down quickly, he picked up and thrust into his pocket the material symbol of what had so voluptuously and so horribly possessed his imagination again, and he wondered where would be a surer place to hide it. But just then, voices were heard. His wife came in with their visitor, and both swam toward him as if through cigarette smoke.
"Ivan, get up, it's time to go. Yes, yes, my dear, I still have so much to pack," said the lady, and then came up to Lucian and began to take leave of him. "Very pleased to have made your acquaintance," she said, and between the words managed to think what she had more than once thought before. What a dunderhead, what a queer fish. "Very pleased. Now I can tell your aunt I've seen her little chess player, big now and famous." "You must not fail to come and see us on your way back," interrupted Mrs. Lucian, hastily and loudly,
for the first time looking with hatred at the woman's smiling wax-red lips and mercilessly stupid eyes.
"But of course it goes without saying. Ivan, get up and say goodbye."
Ivan carried this out with some reluctance, and they all went into the entrance hall.
"There's always a lot of fuss with letting people out here in Berlin," she said, ironically, watching Mrs. Lucian take the keys from the pier table.
"No, we have an elevator," replied Mrs. Lucian irrelevantly, yearning with fierce impatience for the lady's departure,
and she signed to Lucian with her eyebrow to offer the sealskin coat. Lucian instead took down the child's overcoat from the hall stand. But fortunately the maid turned up at this moment.
"Goodbye, goodbye," said Mrs. Lucian,
standing in the doorway while the departing visitors, accompanied by the maid, arranged themselves in the elevator. From behind his wife's shoulder, Lucian saw Ivan clamber onto the little bench, but then the doors closed and the elevator sank down in its iron cage. Mrs. Lucian ran into the study and fell face down on the couch. He sat beside her and began deep down inside him, with difficulty, to produce, glue together, and sew up a smile, preparing it for the moment when his wife turned to him. His wife turned. The smile came out completely successfully.
"Oh," sighed Mrs. Lucian, "we're finally rid of them."
And quickly embracing her husband, she began to kiss him. On the right eye, then the chin, then the left ear, observing a strict sequence that had once been approved by him.
"Well, cheer up," she repeated. "That madam's gone away now, disappeared."
"Disappeared,"
said Lujin obediently, and with a sigh kissed the hand that was patting his neck.
"What tenderness!" whispered his wife. "Ah, what sweet tenderness!"
It was time to go to bed. She went to undress, and Lujin walked through all three rooms, looking for a place to hide the pocket chess set. Everywhere was insecure. The most unexpected places were invaded in the mornings by the snout of that rapacious vacuum cleaner. It is difficult, difficult to hide a thing. The other things are jealous and inhospitable, holding on firmly to their places and not allowing a homeless object escaping pursuit into a single cranny. Thus, he did not manage to hide the Morocco notebook that night, and subsequently he decided not to hide it at all, but simply to get rid of it. But this also proved to be far from easy, so it remained in his lining, and only after several months, when all danger was long, long past, only then was the pocket chess set found again, and by then its origin was obscure.